Meanwhile, back at the Hall of Justice, our mild-mannered podcasters were bombarded by gamma rays, bitten by radioactive bugs, mutated by toxic waste, irradiated with cosmic rays.
Welcome to Talking Comics, episode 251. I'm your host, Mara Wood, and I'm here with Bob Ryer.
Good evening.
Steve Say.
Back stateside.
And Joy Pacino.
Hey, yo.
Hey, hey.
What, what?
So I'm still pumped after that last episode, 250. I mean, I feel like I came in at the last minute because just kind of started regularly being on the podcast, but... I mean, 250 episodes, I think, is quite an achievement.
I would say so.
Yeah.
I've been there for the vast majority of all 250 of them. And that's not even counting, like, some of the special episodes and some of the ones that aren't numbered or, like, live events that we've done and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that show last week, I was buzzing off of that for days.
Yeah.
Yeah, just all the comments and meeting all the cool people. I had no idea. I don't, like, I've been asleep on the job as far as getting to know, like, some of our contributors and stuff like that. And man, like, we got some really, really cool people and talented people in the house right now.
Yeah. The articles that are going up are just of stupendously high quality.
It's fantastic.
And a lot of different kind of books too, which keeps the variety up. And Joey, thank you for shepherding all these new folks into the Talking Comics way of things.
Yeah, dude. I mean, it's a lot easier when they're awesome, you know? And every time we got a new email, new application, it was like wild, these really cool people coming in and just sharing their love of comics. And I think one of the things we learned last week is everybody's got a different story and are coming from a different place. People coming in, you know, young folks in college wanting to write about comics and folks coming back to the medium after years and wanting to share that story. I was still thinking about that... that Batman story that I think Nathan shared with us last week, right? And like when I listened back to the show, that story got me again. Like just the way that he tells it. And if you didn't listen to 250, man, you got to go back. You got to go back and listen to it because it's long, but it's wild and one of the best, I think.
I've actually been in touch with somebody via Twitter, one of our listeners who's a new listener, and they've gone back to the very first episode and are working their way forward.
Good God.
And within the span of, I think it was maybe not even 2 weeks, they had done 99 episodes of the show.
Wow. Are they just listening to it 24 hours?
Yeah, did I
they
have do no like, idea.
Because some of those like early shows are
did like Silk, they're in a bunker.
Oh my God. Yeah. Some of those early shows are so bad.
10 Cloverfield Lane, but listening to Talking
Comics.
It's
going to be cool for them, though, because they're going to get to see the evolution of the show, and there's no better way to do that than to binge something like that. I just don't know that I would want to hear my own voice for that long and that consistently. Damn.
Yeah.
You guys used to do, didn't you guys do like a radio play like once or twice?
Yeah.
Yes. We should do that again.
Yes, we definitely should do that again.
There is one.
Yeah, there is one.
There's another one written.
Bob's been hanging on to a gem for years. Maybe we finally have the right cast to make that happen.
We have all sorts of ways to do that now.
We do.
We have extra people who we didn't have before.
Yo, we can get the people that came on to the 250 to do like all the tertiary characters.
Well, the crazy thing is that we had how many contributors call in? 6 last week? There's still 8 more, and the numbers just keep going on that we weren't able to fit on last week. So they're all ready and raring to go. So
good.
So Mara, would you be ready to play the neighborhood flirt?
Oh,
sure thing, Bob.
Okay. I thought I was going to audition for that part. What are you talking about?
Diversity in casting.
Oh man,
we could try that. Yep. There are parts and parts.
What would be my part?
Still have the part you had.
What, the old man?
You're Raymond, our narrator.
Oh, my God, right. That's right. Oh, sweet. All right, yeah, I could definitely conjure some Raymond again.
Had done a... It was for our other show. It was our next to last episode. I had written this sort of Lovecraftian film noir romance thing.
Ooh.
And it was basically us doing five or six voices each, which you know, we tried. You had more differing voices than any of us.
I tried.
You did the Southern preacher guy. You did the doorman.
Yep.
Jameson, the doorman.
Just wait until you need like some crotchety Igor type of character.
Mm-hmm. Are you ready,
Oh, yeah. I got all kinds
of
stuff.
Well, you could do the narrator in a crotchety Tales from the Crypt kind of voice if you choose. We could try that. That could work.
I'm going to warn you. You know, I used to be a dungeon master for years and had to play lots of different non-player characters. I've got two voices. The one you're hearing right now and like an old high-pitched lady. That's it. It's
somewhere in between. We want in between.
You have to work on that third, right in the middle.
Yeah, like right in the middle. The witch that lives in the tree hollow.
Yes, but she has to also be crazy because that's the only way that voice works. She's just a little bit crazy.
We keep talking about this. I'm going to start busting out voices.
This next one, what it was written to be, we were sitting around afterwards, and let's do that again. That was fun. And so I showed up. It was some trivia night, actually. I showed up with 12 index cards. Here are my ideas for what we should do next. And sort of passed them around. And the one that came out was sort of, it's a sci-fi comedy that turned everything from the other one on its head. So it's sort of like one of those comedy episodes of The Twilight Zone.
I like it.
That sounds awesome.
It's been passed through a lot of hands. A lot of people have seen it. A couple of sort of professional people, one Peter David's wife, seemed to like it.
Ooh. Look at you.
Yeah. Mm. So it's been finagled with and monkeyed with and poured over for, I don't know, 4 years.
Yeah, a while.
So, but
it's been refined. Refined is the word.
Yeah, refined. That's a better word.
Polished to a fine sheen. It became part of this show because Hurricane Sandy took out a Halloween Eve interview with Amy Reeder and Brandon Montclair for their book Halloween Eve. Mm-hmm. So we had to run something. So I said to Bobby, "Well, we've got an entire like hour episode that's a play, and it's horror. So why don't we run that for Halloween?" And we got some very nice responses. Now we did some of those. Let's read an old comic book kind of thing, which I think should definitely. We should definitely do some of those.
Yeah,
I'm reading Walt Simonson's Thor right now, and that needs to be narrated.
Yes, Steve, you could break out the troll voice.
Oh, I definitely could.
Yeah.
We are hyping this up like crazy right now.
It's gonna happen. It's gonna happen.
But it's gonna work. It will work.
It's gonna be stellar.
We can, you know, I don't know if we can. Female lead was written with Jackie in mind, and some of her expressions are definitely hers, taken from real life. Mm-hmm. So I think we might have to adjourn to there.
Okay.
And that way we have an extra three or four people.
Yeah, definitely.
Because then we drag Bobby into this because he's supposed to be in it too. And we've got now, instead of us each doing five voices and me doing them badly, I kept drifting it back into me.
I wonder how the voices are going to change.
I did at Rutgers, they do at the radio station, we did Christmas Carol every year.
Nice.
Nice.
And the first year I did it, they called me up to participate because there were no girls that were available to read the parts. So I played all the girl parts. Me and a friend of mine, two dudes,
awesome.
Played all the girls in our Monty Python falsettos.
Hey, that's the way you do it. That's the way Shakespeare did it, right?
Yeah dude.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, so Shakespeare had got young boys whose, you know, voices hadn't changed, but
yeah,
I don't know if I could pull that off.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't want any of those. I think I did young Mary Marvel, didn't I?
Ooh. Yes, you did. Yeah. Yes, you did.
That wasn't very good, but I tried.
Stephanie's Mole Man was classic. That was so good.
Yeah.
That was so good.
He became very Southern.
Yeah, after a little while, he really did. But he's, you know, he's down below in the ground.
Right, yeah. He's,
hey. And south.
That's south at
the
some
deep
level.
South.
South. Oh.
Oh, speaking of deep south, later in this episode, we're going to be talking about March the entire Good March trilogy.
Ooh.
God.
Which, yeah. Yeah.
Nice. Tears may flow. Tears may flow, guys.
Yeah. So both Joey and Steve are like bantering back and forth about, we should do March, we should do March, which actually caused me to go out and finally read it, because I bought volumes 1 and 2 a long time ago, but never sat down and read them. And I'm glad I did. And did it for this podcast. Mm. So thank you, Talking Comics, making a more diverse comic reader out of me.
Yeah.
Looking out for you, Mara.
Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate it, guys.
Waking you up.
Waking me up.
Stay woke. Whoa,
oh, I knew it.
I set you up. I tried to set you up there.
Yeah, man. It's going to happen at least a few more times.
But before we get into that discussion, we've got some lightning rounds to get through. Mm-hmm. And let's start off with Bob.
Okey-doke.
You ready?
Yep.
Okay, go ahead.
Doctor Strange number 11 by Jason Aaron and Kevin Nolan this time around is mostly a catching your breath issue. And as that, it's okay, but as I was left somewhat flat at the finale of the last arc, I was hoping for more from this as a new beginning. So as much as I've enjoyed most of the first 10 issues, this series is going to have to win me back over again. Particularly Ooh. If Chris Bocciolo has left, which we don't know.
Oh.
Silk number 11 by Robbie Thompson and Tana Ford finds Cindy and her friends Lola and Rafferty scouring the negative zone for Cindy's missing parents, which becomes quite a quest that features Red Knights, Ash Kings, and talking dragons named David. Now, lots of fun in this story, certainly, and Ms. Ford's art has taken a turn toward the all-red zone, which really works awfully beautifully for those who have yet to see that one. All New, All Different Avengers, number 14, by Mark Waid, Jeremy Whitley, and Adam Kubert. I purchased this solely to see what Jeremy would do with The Wasp, as he's going to be doing that book with Elsa Chartier moving forward. And it's a lovely tale as Nadia Pym bonds with her stepmother, Janet, during some really tough circumstances during this Civil War thing. Lots of humor, but also very touching. Nadia's exasperation, Jeremy's too, I suspect, over the superhero shenanigans, it bubbles over with this tear-stained and telling phrase, "They're the best we've got. They have to do better."
Ooh.
Amen. Yeah. Squadron Supreme number 11, James Robinson, Leonard Kirk, is a battlefield issue, but not at the expense of Mr. Robinson's usual deft characterizations. Warrior Woman and Modred the Mystic have broken into the Baxter Building in order to use Doctor Doom's time machine because they want to resurrect Prince Namor to fulfill one of Ulysses' prophecies about her ruling the world, which I think is a really nice commentary on the idea of predictive justice and self-fulfilling prophecies.
Hmm.
Now, speaking of the tenants of the Baxter Building, with our 250th episode on my mind, I reread two Fantastic Four anniversary issues, number 236, which was their 20th anniversary, and the 2005 40th winning anniversary special. 236 is by John Byrne with colors by Glynis Wine, and was his fifth issue as writer-artist and one of my favorite single issues of all time, number 6, actually, titled Terror in a Tiny Town, opens on the familiar origin, which turns out to be Johnny having a terribly bad dream. We meet the rest of the family, who are now totally human and residing in the bucolic hamlet of Littleville. But what it is, it's a nightmare that they're all experiencing, not just Johnny and Reed, after a run-in with his boss at the college, Professor Vaughn, decides to experiment on himself to prove it's all real and stabs himself, which doesn't quite work the way he thinks. There's a huge surprise, wonderfully done, perfect characterization of all these characters you'd expect from John Byrne, and it is sensational. You should always pick that one up. The 40th wedding anniversary special, Carl Kessel and Drew Johnson. It is basically Reed and Sue get these mysterious invitations to a gala at Tavern on the Green and show up and discover multiple iterations of themselves from all across their lives together.
And what?
Yes, there's a surprise as to who's called this party, and I'll just leave it at that.
So
that's
cool. I've read
the 40th wedding anniversary special. Thank you for the extra time, Dr. Mara.
You're very welcome. I read that all new, all different Avengers as well.
Uh-huh.
And I was very pleased because it would have been so easy to write Janet and Nadia as adversaries here. With Nadia coming in to take the Wasp mantle and Janet didn't really know about her and kind of this, you know, unknown child and things like that. But I loved the fact that they were so warm and welcoming to each other and really spent all that time bonding and getting to know each other, and Janet stepping into that mother role very easily and willingly as well. And of course the reaction to what's going on in the bigger Marvel universe. I mean, I'm right there with you. They're supposed to be better than this. Yeah. They're superheroes.
Yeah. It's lovely. She has this little tear forming as she mm-hmm. says it, then decides, I'm really smart. I can find a way to fix this.
Yep. Yep.
And that's the kind of person we need. Maybe we get her together with Lunella Lafayette. We can sort all this Civil War stuff out. Yes. By the way, on the Civil War front, news was released today about the delay. Shocking, I know. It's now end of the year before we see the end of the conflict. Yes, December 28th will be Civil War II, number 8.
Happy Christmas.
So far away.
It was supposed to be out in about 2 weeks, and it's 2 months down the road.
I could have swore there was going to be an issue tomorrow, right? Didn't it get bumped to tomorrow? And then it wasn't on the solicits, and I was like, oh, no.
It's not on there. Mm-hmm. I looked about an hour ago. It ain't there.
Yeah. I admittedly, the artist, David, is it David Vasquez?
David Marquez.
David Marquez, mm-hmm. Okay. Wife just had a baby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wife just broke her leg.
Oh really?
Yeah.
What?
So it's been delayed and so it's family stuff and I get it, but now they're adding an extra issue because it went from 7 to 8. But there was something interesting. Look, it's a different world of comics than it was, and I'm gonna get off my lawn. He's doing a page a day.
Yeah.
And they're pleased with that. Mm-hmm. Well, in 1963, Jack Kirby did 2,100 pages of Marvel Comics. It can be done. You know, you can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think with the circumstances, though, it's still a tall order. I mean, I haven't the slightest clue as to what goes into making a comic book page these days, especially if you're working with digital. And you're transferring your sketches.
I don't mean to compare, but it's funny the juxtaposition of the two numbers in and of themselves. To me, as with the Image stuff that ends up being delayed far too often, and these sort of books, in the 70s, books got delayed a lot, and then they ended up, the dread deadline doom, they had fill-in issues. They had inventory stuff that they would then create a framing sequence. While this was going on, Hawkeye was thinking about this, and you get some little side story by somebody else. Why aren't these finished or more finished before they start soliciting the books? People have speculated the idea is they can more easily now change on the fly as audiences react to what's happening in a storyline and then can start to shift things a little bit so they're closer to deadline than they once were. I don't know. Speculation for stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is kind of the same thing that lost me with Secret Wars, where the distance between issues was so great that I just stopped caring. Mm-hmm. But, you know, with Secret Wars, I wasn't reading very many of the tie-ins, but with Civil War II, I am. So, you know, an issue like this one where, you know, the Wasp and the is it Unstoppable? Wasp.
She'll be the Unstoppable Wasp.
Unstoppable. So Old Wasp and Unstoppable Wasp. Seeing
old
them
wasp.
Talk about it. Old Wasp. Old Wasp.
I don't know if Janet would like that.
Yeah. She would not. I'm going to call her the mature, fashionable, emotional.
Classy Wasp. Classic Wasp.
That's better. But having an issue of a series I already read where they're talking about it and addressing it once more, you know, it is keeping me in the Civil War too. Mentality. So they at least got that going for them. Okay. Steve, mm-hmm. are you ready to talk about your books?
Yes.
All right.
Surely.
Go for it.
All right. This week I've got Glitter Bomb number 1 from Image Comics for you, written by Jim Zub, line art by Jabril Morissette Fan, and colors by K. Michael Russell. Ahem. The book opens with a film executive, Douche Canoe, explaining to our main character and struggling actress, Farah, that she simply isn't trend-fuckable enough for the role in which she's auditioned. To this, well, read the book and find out. Truthfully, I didn't know anything about Glitter Bomb prior to its release. I bought it simply on the merit of Skullkicker and Wayward creator Jim Zub. To my surprise, what I got is a twisted sci-fi horror book with endearing characters and a side of body horror.
Yeah, dude.
I'm really excited to pick up another issue. I want to learn more about Farah and see how she copes with her new set of circumstances. I really, really love kind of the, not even an undertone, it's more like an overtone. I love the Hollywood shaming vibe of the book and the way it exposes the truthful ugliness of an industry that's built on like glad handing and always looking for that new 15-minute piece of ass. So it's really, really good stuff. You got to check it out. Barrier number 1 and 2. This is written by Brian K. Vaughan with art by Marcos Martin. If you remember, that's the team behind, oh my God, The Private Eye. This is one of those pay what you want, and you can go to panelsyndicate.com to check it out. So the deal is this. Liddy is a rancher who lately has been the victim of a series of crimes that have recently taken place on her land. And one afternoon, she finds the severed head of one of her prized horses, Sprinkles, rotting in the hot desert sun. She suspects that it's the work of an angry coyote whose job is made harder by the location of her farm, but when a man carrying a mysterious book by the name of Oscar ends up wounded on her property, Liddy will soon discover that it's something far more sinister and alien that's encroaching on her land. Really, really beautiful, cool book with a kind of like a slow burn delivery of an invasion story. And it's one of the interesting things about it, its presentation, is that it's half English, half Spanish. There are a lot of Spanish-speaking characters in the book, and there are whole pages and whole scenes where it's just Spanish-speaking characters. I didn't care because I don't know Spanish fluently, but the art that was happening in this book, like, you know what's being said and you know what's going on just by the characters' actions and kind of the scenery and everything. It really made me want to bust out a translator and figure out what was being said. Really, really intriguing. The pacing of it, like I said, is excellent. And once you get to the more alien aspects of the book, the art just goes to another level. Kind of reminded me of Christian Ward's work on Odyssey a little bit. And seriously, the pay-as-you-go thing is beautiful and brave, and I love it.
Yeah.
So instead of old-fashioned cattle mutilation, it's horse mutilation.
Yeah, it's, you know, like, what is happening to my farm? And she, like, the border, right? Like, the gate, like, the fence with the barbed wire is right at the edge of her property. So she figures that it's people trying to jump over. And in the process, they're, you know, destroying her. She has crops. She has animals and stuff like that. And where she's located, it makes it very difficult for them to cross. So she figures that one of the coyotes who's losing out on that route is terrorizing, you know, her animals and her livestock and stuff like that. And that ain't exactly what's going on.
Interesting.
So it's definitely, it's an interesting time for this to be coming out, particularly with all the Trump stuff going on with the whole build a wall and blah, blah, blah. It is an interesting commentary on that when you have people coming over that would technically be illegal aliens being then abducted by aliens, making the reader question the concept of the word alien and who really, you know, these are people, you know, and if I was sucked up into a UFO, I'd be, ugh, not cool, man.
Yeah.
Not cool. But, super great stuff. It's, again, it's just, it's panelsyndicate.com, and you pay what you want. You could pay a penny if you want to. Like, the minimal thing is zero. So, really awesome. You can download it in 3 different ways, like CBZ, PDF, whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's good. It's really good. It was a nice surprise. I actually found out about it through Kotaku.com.
Yeah.
They hardly ever cover comic book stuff. It's all video games. And they had a thing, and I said, Brian K. Vaughan, and I just went, whoa.
Click on it.
What? Yeah,
I actually have, like, Barrier number 1 sitting in my Google Drive right now, waiting for me to read.
Yeah.
And I've just been putting it off. So
I think you'll like it. It's really good. It's very atmospheric. They mm-hmm. do some, like, before Liddy actually meets Oscar, they do a lot of, like, this is what she's doing, this is what he's doing. And as you go along with these, like, these silent panels every couple pages, you start to see the thread of where their paths might cross.
Right.
And it, yeah, like, there's this language barrier between them because he only speaks Spanish, she only speaks English. And now they're abducted and have to figure things out together, and working together is difficult because of, you know, they can't mm-hmm. really talk it out.
Communicate, yeah.
So, good stuff.
Awesome, awesome. Joey, are you ready?
Yes. I am ready.
Go ahead.
All right, so I'm going to talk about Alters number one this week. Paul Jenkins, Leila Laiz, Tamara Bonvillon for Aftershock. So reading this book, a book that was solicited by Aftershock as the, quote, kind of first to prominently feature a transgendered superhero in the lead, I had this, like, weird feeling reading the book. I couldn't really place it. The book itself, reading it, felt very X-Men-y, which, you know, you guys know I'm a big fan of. The basic premise is we have these alters who are people who suddenly manifest these wild powers that puts them at odds with the general population because they're outsiders and the fear and all of that. And then we have this protagonist, Chalice, who gets her powers, and then it's revealed, or we find out, I guess we already knew from the solicits, that she's trans and still hiding her transitioning from her family and will have to come out soon. Again, it's very X-Men-y, but something just felt weird about the book, no matter how really good the writing is and really cool the artwork is. And then I tuned into Magdalene Visaggio of Kim and Kim fame, who has rapidly become one of my very favorite creators on Twitter. And I found this piece that she wrote for Paste Magazine. And I just want to read just a little bit here that she wrote in there. She wrote, quote, "There's a distinction between telling a story with a transgender person in it and telling a trans story. The former is the purview of any writer. Kieran Gillen, Gail Simone, and Marguerite Bennett, among others, all handle this approach admirably. But the other, well, the other is not. Let me draw from my own work if I can. I make a very deliberate point of centering transgender characters in my writing. My character's transness, however, is very rarely the focus of their story. Being a trans woman is honestly super dull and mostly involves boob pain and dealing with people staring at you on the subway. Meanwhile, transition narratives tend to get kind of samey, and I've certainly experienced enough trans angst in my life to avoid doing stories where the entire focus is, oh, woe is me, I am trans and sad, and my parents will never understand. I lived that, it sucked, and it's boring. But it's still mine. It's ours. It's unique to being trans. And I'm extremely curious what possessed Paul Jenkins of the notion that this story was somehow his to tell. In doing so, he turns transgender identity into something to be stared at." Close quote. And she goes on to talk about how the book does try to draw allegorical connections between Charlie's transition into Chalice in terms of identity and the new Alters power set kind of premise. But issue one dwells far too long and too awkwardly on a very kind of stereotypical version of the closeted narrative. I love Jenkins. His work on Sentry is some of the best comics to come out of Marvel from the early 2000s, and Leila Laiz is a breakout talent, and you guys know I love Tamara Bonvillon, and her name is awesome. But look, to write a transgender narrative does not require the writer to be transgender. However, it does require a certain care and authenticity to make it something unique and real. If Alters was about being different and fighting for a world that doesn't understand you, a la the X-Men, then it would be totally cool and fitting to have someone like Chalice in the book. But Alters number one spends too much time being about how Charlie Chalice's transition, and Jenkins just doesn't achieve the authenticity required to nail it, and the ending is weird. I don't know if I went over time, but
that's
oh, look at that.
I was watching the timer go down. I was like, oh, he's gonna make it. He's
and that's how it. I feel.
Yeah. I'm with you on Alters. I read it.
Yeah, look, I like reading the book.
Oh, go ahead. I think we oh, there it is. Your sound cut out there for a minute, Joey.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, that's fine.
No, go ahead. You were saying something.
Yeah. So I had the same feeling when I was reading Alters earlier today. And I was like, this is a little bit too much on the nose for me. And I think part of it is because we don't have very many stories of transitioning without the sci-fi element or without the superhero element. And throwing all of that together at once can just be overwhelming when really I just want to focus on one thing or the other, as we're getting the beginnings of those kinds of stories coming out, that I want more of a real life transitioning story and how that happens in the real world before I try to connect it to a fictional world and things like that. So that's kind of where I was with it, where I'm like, I had read the tweets and the conversations from Mags before this issue. So I kind of had that mentality going into it. And I was like, you know what? This is really cool and everything. But we've had so many of the superheroes who, you know, represent being outside of society and being different from society and having to hide their identities and things like that. We've had that over and over again. I don't need that explicit of a connection in order to understand that connection. I want almost a, I want to know what it's like in real life without the fictional fantastical element to it.
Yeah. It was so explicitly kind of set up to that kind of direct parallel. Yeah. They did that Iceman stuff. Bendis did it a couple of years ago, and they executed that really well. And I'll always remember there was that book, Young X-Men. Mark Guggenheim, I think, did it. And that book was like 12 issues. Very few people read it. But there was one issue with Anole who was struggling with coming out to his family. And it was like they didn't have to come out and be like, but you're a mutant. This is like exactly like your life. Like that's not something that needs to be said in those narratives.
Yeah.
And I felt like Alters did that very, very, very on the nose.
Like, see, here's the connection.
And her article on Paste is spectacular. If you just to read, even if you haven't read the book, her article on Paste just talks about this idea and talks about writing these kinds of narratives and talks about her issue with not only this book but some of the films that are coming out too. She talks about A Danish Girl with Eddie Redmayne did he win the Academy Award for that? He may have. I don't remember.
He was at least nominated.
Yeah. So she gets into a lot of it, which is it's a great piece on Paste.
Steve, were you going to say something about that?
I was. I don't know. I don't know how much. I was just going to say in regard to Kim and Kim and the way that it's written. I like that there are trans characters in the book, and that is a make of the book.
Yeah.
But that's all it is. Like they don't, Saggio doesn't spend too much time focusing on it. Like it just is. And these characters, they are who they are, and it's an adventure. It's not about teaching and it's, I don't know.
It's normalizing.
I like it when, not that it's a background thing, because obviously it's an important aspect of their characters, but it's not. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you. That is the word that I was struggling to find. Indeed.
Awesome.
Yes. Thank you.
Well, I'm going to go ahead. No problem. I'm here for finding the words. I'm going to go ahead with my lightning round. Make sure I have all my books on hand. Okay. So first up is Everyone's Getting Married, Volume 2 from Viz Media. By Izumi Miyazono. So this is, we're still following Asuka and Ryu as they're starting their relationship together, where Asuka wants to be married and Ryu doesn't really see much of a point to it. He doesn't see the value. I know. And they're in this early relationship and she's like, should I stay with him even though I know he doesn't want to be married? And he's like, should I stay with her even though she wants to be married and I don't? And both of them are kind of like, they have real good reasons why they believe one way or another, but it's kind of like, okay, who's going to make the compromise? Where is it going to go? But it's just kind of furthering their relationships. And besides the whole marriage thing, Ryo is a broadcaster for a popular Japanese news program. So he's constantly busy and they're having to learn how to navigate those waters together. Okay, in American comic world, I read Ever After number 1, and this is the post-Fables Vertigo comic. It's actually the first Vertigo comic I've bought in a long time. Huh. So I'm kind of like, okay, I guess we're getting back into this. By Dave Justice, Matthew Sturgis, and Travis Moore. And it is the Fables that we know fighting against the new fables, the new legends and things like that. So the first page kind of opens up with little Bo Peep fighting a bunch of zombies in St. Louis. So I'm like, okay, I can see where they're going with this modern myth, modern fable kind of aspect there. We see Snow White and Bigsby, and they're one of their cubs, Connor, who's basically an adult now and getting a job and things like that. So it's kind of a neat little post-Fables comic. It might actually convince me to finish reading Fables. So Superman, number 6, by Peter J. Tomasi, Patrick Gleason. This is kind of the end of that Eradicator arc that's been going on. And it ends good. Like, I'm pretty satisfied with it as far as the opening arc for the Superman main title. This has been, I think, pretty consistently one of the better Rebirth comics to come out. Right under Wonder Woman. Like, Wonder Woman's still at the top, guys. I'm looking forward to seeing where John Kent goes, since he's starting to become more and more of a hero in his own right, and how Batman and Damian are going to cope with that. Speaking of Batman, Batman number 6 has a lot of Gotham Girl in it. This one's by Tom Keane and Ivan Reyes. And this is after Gotham Girl's brother passes away and how she's dealing with that loss. And it was just
spoilers.
Kind of...
Spoiler alert!
This is a comic review show, you know. Listen at your own risk. Like, if...
I was going to say, like, oh, we got most of the lightning rounds without mentioning Wonder Woman, and then you threw it in right there.
Sorry. but this particular issue, you know, Bruce is trying to figure out, like, Alfred, how did you pull me out of that depression? How did you pull me out of that that feeling? So he recognizes the pain in Gotham Girl and reaches out in his own way. So, yeah. Didn't even get to my Star Wars book, so y'all are lucky, I guess.
What?
Yeah, missing out on that one.
Throw it in. Go ahead.
Poe Dameron.
Talk about it.
Poe Dameron, number 6, Charles Soule, Phil Noto. The Carrion Spike is the most badass ship in the Imperial Navy. Or I guess it's actually the First Order.
First Order
Navy is what they would call it now. But it used to be in the Imperial Navy because it was Grand Moff Tarkin's corvette. Ooh. So it is like the image of how this ship just destroys things is the coolest thing I ever saw drawn, and y'all should go look at it. It's amazing.
Have they shown us enough of Poe Dameron's abs in this book?
No, not enough, not any. I don't think he's wearing a flight suit. Just like, guys,
then why are we reading it?
I thought, but you know, I'm reading it for the really cool space battles and Grokkus the Hutt. I'm really into Grokkus.
I would have read it for Phil Noto's version of Oscar Isaac. That's what.
Yeah, it's. I mean, it's pretty. It's pretty. let's see. Do we have any news?
Surprises, by the way, at the end of Superman, right?
Yeah. Yes.
No. Not particularly. Except that we sort of newsed the secret civil whatever it is war is being delayed. We did that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
News?
Yes.
I think we can go to the main event.
Someone, yeah. Steve, someone joined I Kill Giants. I'm blanking on who it was. I'll find out.
Somebody joined the movie?
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, what's her name? She's going to be playing Sophie.
Okay.
Imogen Poots. Imogen Poots.
On... Yes.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow. She's considerably old for that part.
No, I think you're thinking
is
of somebody
she playing
else.
That
anyway.
Part?
Sophie's she's the bully, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, she's supposed to be a kid. Imogen...
Well, maybe she's been left back a few times.
Maybe I'm thinking of the wrong actress.
No, Imogen Poots reads like young 20s. I could see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, she is not a young... I mean, whatever, we're getting
anyway.
Far away from it. I am fearful for that movie only because I don't know when it's coming out, but that new movie is getting
called The Monster Calls is getting ridiculously rave reviews. The one of the little boy and his mother, I think, has cancer, and a drawing that he has done over the years comes to life to save him. It looks spectacular.
It's based on a novel.
Yeah, one of my coworkers has already seen it, and he was raving to me about it. And he's like, dude, you're going to be a wreck. Yeah. And but even in the trailer, there are definitely shades of I Kill Giants. And I'm just hoping that when I Kill Giants finally is released, that people don't moan and be like, oh, they're just doing, you know, that again.
They're ripping off. Yeah.
I don't know if they will, though, because I feel like, I don't know if I Kill Giants even has a release date. I just brought up the news because it's like, it's really happening. There's just another step towards it occurring. But also, I think that there are differences. I think that we have this little boy in this story, and the whole like Liam Neeson forest monster thing in there is I think a little different than what Joe Kelly does with I Kill Giants.
Yeah, for sure. I'm looking forward to both. You know, it's going to be awesome having, I mean, to, what is it? I keep forgetting the title of it. Let me explain something to the audience really quick. I was telling Bob before we started, I've had 6 hours of sleep since Sunday morning, and this is Tuesday night. So if I'm a little off tonight, it's because I am very tired, and I apologize, but, I really can't wait to see what Joe Kelly... Knowing that Joe Kelly is on the ground floor of that movie and that he fought to keep things in it and kept shopping it around until he got his way makes me super, super happy to see what's going to go on with that.
Yeah, he's very, very excited. I saw him at the Eternal Con.
Yeah.
Over here on Long Island. He was very, very pleased with the progress being made. So, fingers crossed, because that book means a lot to all of us.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Want it to be perfect.
All right. So before we get into our discussion on March, which I know many of us are real excited about that, I want to talk about Paper Girls. Or actually, Bob wants to talk about Paper Girls, and I want to talk about it with him.
Okay.
I gotta take my headphones off because I don't want to be spoiled.
You need to read it. You need to read it every month.
I'm trade rating, which is terrible.
The worst idea for this book.
I know.
Right, because
I know.
Each issue.
I regret my whole life.
Joey, this issue. You wonder what happens in this issue? We're gonna tell you. We're gonna tell you right now.
Oh dear God.
No, we'll avoid spoiling it, but just to say. For the most part, I've complained a lot about modern comics, image books particularly, how you can definitely read them as a big chunk and it enhances the reading. This is the one, this is the exception that proves the rule, because every month you get a great cliffhanger and a resolution the next month that ends up being part and parcel of why there's going to be a cliffhanger at the end of the next issue.
Yeah.
So they all link together in this wonderful chain. And they can be read the other way, but it's so much fun to go, how are they going to get out of this? How did they get there? So in this one, without spoiling too much, we discovered near the end of the last issue that there's a third Erin. We have Paper Girl Erin, Old Lady Erin. She's all of, 30. And now there's Erin number 3, who it turns out is a clone.
Yes.
A clone created by leftover blood from little nanobots that were used to fix her bullet wound somewhere in the future that then survived a crash by her uncle and they pulled it out of the remains.
Naturally.
Now, that's all in about the first 4 pages. And it all just takes off from there. It's just clever dialogue. The characters are great. You continue to move through the new future to the young girls that is sort of our not so hot 20th century or 21st century. Giant monsters, weird steampunk airships and pterodactyls and Quetzalcoatli and whatever flying around, giant leechy things.
Yes.
Big Pacific Rim monsters wandering about the flats of Cleveland. And now we're getting into the 4th and 5th foldings. Come on. And a killer, killer ending. I loved when Old Erin is speaking to the clone version of herself, who has given us some instructions about what they should be doing next. Why should we trust our incredibly creepy kid doppelganger? No offense. Which is then echoed back a little bit later by Aaron number three, talking about just old timers in general, someone who've been chasing her across the various timelines. You know, like most people over 30, they're monsters.
Mm-hmm.
No
they
offense.
They don't get it.
No offense. It's just, Brian K. Vaughan, just so, so clever. Each of the girls has a different vibe to them. They're individual characters. Mm-hmm. Old Erin is, I think she's getting into it. The whole adventure, despite the giant monsters and floating field hockey sticks and all the rest of it. There's something mm-hmm. it takes her out of the life she had, because she's a little jealous of her sister, the helicopter pilot, who we see here.
Yeah.
So what? Now that I've monopolized all that, Mara, what did you think?
I'm on the same page with you on all these things, and I really want to point out that in our last Legendary Runs episode, we did Brian K. Vaughan's Ex Machina, and it was like Matt said something about Vaughan being the master of that final page spread, like that final mm-hmm. page, splash page that takes you into the next issue. And sure enough, I pick up Paper Girls and suddenly noticing the final page, you know, lead into the next issue. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was kind of like, oh, well, now I see it again. So, you know, I don't think that it's the same thing with Saga. With Paper Girls and Saga, they're both consistently good every single month, but not enough people talk about how awesome it is. Like, there's a lot of hype in the beginning, but I just want to reiterate, this is still one of the best comic issues out there. And if you have superhero fatigue, if you have event fatigue, if you have rebirth fatigue, look to Paper Girls and, you know, fall back in love with comics.
Yes. 100%.
Yep.
I put my headphones back on just for that ringing endorsement.
That is a pull quote.
Fall back in love with comics, guys.
Read
Paper Girls.
And fall back in love with comics. Dr. Mara Wood, talking comics.
Yes.
Yeah, dude.
Mm-hmm. Look, they have. It's nice they got to put this page in their own book. 2016 Eisner Award winners, Best New Series and Best Artist.
Yeah.
So, as it should have been. Was it our Best New Series?
I was going to say, in 2016, Talking Comics, yeah. something, probably.
Yeah.
it was probably like at least top
maybe,
five.
Maybe Best New Series?
Or Best, it was definitely Best New.
I think it was Best New Series because it had just started coming out. Because we're on issue 9 in September.
Or was it Lady Killer?
3-month break, yeah. So they might have had
That was Lady Killer.
Mini. That would have been Best Mini.
Yeah. There was a lot of drama about Lady Killer. I remember that.
Man, I remember listening to that award show in my hotel room in Vancouver, just yelling and screaming and being like, ah, no! It was so good. It was so funny.
We're getting to that point again?
Yes, real soon. I've been making a little list for
myself. I was thinking about that the other day. Dude, it's September.
Yeah, dude. It's coming up.
Gonna have to lock it in soon.
I'm ready to lock something in right now and talk to you guys about it after we're done recording. But there's
look
definitely
that.
Something that's gonna come up at the end of the year, for sure.
Nice. So let's look at March.
Steve.
All right. Would you like to open up the floor for discussion?
Yeah, I'll lead the charge on this one, and then I'll pass it off to Joey, and then we can all come in. So, little story about this real quick is I was out in Canada going to my favorite comic shop, Heroes, and knew that the March box set series was going to be hitting the shelves. And the thing that I love about Heroes is that they are the biggest comic book store in all of Ontario. They're now two floors instead of one, and an extra back. It's like having two stores in one location. It's crazy. So there's tons of stuff to choose from. I had like all three volumes of Stumptown and the Wonder Woman and a couple of other things. And I looked at Bronwyn, and she's like, you know, you want to buy March. You know that
ooh.
Like... this is what you should be buying because you know that the Rucka is going to be good, guaranteed. So why don't you take a chance on this and get this instead? And I cannot thank her enough for pushing me in that direction, because holy hell, For those of you who don't know what March is a 3-volume series that just capped about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago this came out.
August 2nd, yeah. I want to say.
It's presented by Top Shelf, and it is written by Representative John Lewis, Andrew Aiden, and Nate Powell is the team behind this series. And so I put together a little thing using a little bit of Wikipedia and a little bit of my own stuff to tell you all who John Lewis is exactly before we get into the meat of this thing. So John Lewis is the U.S. representative for Georgia's 5th Congressional District and has been serving since 1987. Additionally, wow, he's the chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, and was one of the big six of groups who organized the 1963 March on Washington, an act in which Lewis and his constituents sought to obtain the right for blacks to vote and share their voice as equals in political matters within the state of Georgia and beyond. Lewis has been advocating and fighting to end the racial segregation for most of his life, and his accomplishments throughout the years have served to change the face of the nation in ways that will inspire generations to come. All of that is true. And so what you have here with March is you have this completely epic retelling of John Lewis from his childhood all the way to Obama being indoctrinated into the White House, and John Lewis's contribution towards black rights, towards the nonviolent way of being political and standing up for what you believe in, and the many, many people. It's not solely about John Lewis throughout this book. He makes sure to give tips of the hat or directly thank and mention several other members of several organizations throughout this book. All of this stuff did not happen with just one man. It's just that John Lewis is kind of the anchor or the linchpin that we hold on to in this story. I didn't know anything about John Lewis. I didn't even know that he was alive and breathing before I picked up this book. I'd heard from a couple people that Volume 1 was amazing and that it was something that you really needed to read. And I was always interested, but it never crossed my path. Like, I never saw it in a store. I didn't see it on, like, an Amazon store. Like, oh, I'll go, you know, I'll pick that up. And I'm really glad that I waited to get all 3 volumes at once, because sitting down to read all 3 in a row was such, like, an education about the nonviolent movement and about the atrocious way in which the black community has been treated and is treated presently throughout all of history. And watching the struggle and watching the being able to look adversity in the face, have it beating you down into the ground and kicking your teeth in and not raising a fist and not, you know, using your words and using your beliefs to fight it and organizing and everything, getting arrested repeatedly over and over and over again, spending the night in jail, getting out the next day, and then going directly from the jail to the next march and doing it again, and getting arrested again, and then getting out and doing it again the next day. And the dedication and the repetition is just so ridiculously inspiring. And reading about all of these people, I couldn't believe some of the stuff that I was seeing in this book. There's one character who, named of Sheriff Clark, he is kind of the chief of things in Alabama at that time. And he's kind of poised as the villain, particularly in the 3rd novel, where, I mean, when I say villain, he's just a, you know,
antagonist.
An antagonist, yeah. A really shitty person that was a part of this movement and opposed to it. And, there's this one part in the book where we see all these instances where he is attacking the people who are marching, and they're trying to reach Selma, and they're trying to get on the groups are trying to get on the ballot, and he's sending dogs, he's sending tear gas, he is beating the living crap out of these people, and through the stress of the planning to make barricades and just the opposing these groups of people, he winds up giving himself something of a panic attack / like pseudo heart attack thing and winds up in the hospital. He's in the hospital And outside of his, out of the hospital itself, all the people who were marching have stopped their march to gather around, holding signs up for him to get well and to get better, even after he was directly responsible for beatings and deaths and standing in their way at every single turn. And this, pardon me, but this motherfucker is sitting in his hospital bed and he asks one of his people to get him a button press. And he has them bring the button press to the hospital, and he makes a pin, and he adds it to, like, his officer's suit on his lapel, where, like, his badge and all of his other crap are, and all the button says on it, in one word, is never. Even after they gathered to wish him well and to stand on equal ground, and he walks out of that hospital with a new pin that just says the word never on it. And I just... I was in the airport and I'm reading this book and I got my headphones on and, like, I don't know what I sound like outside the headphones because I listen to my music pretty loud, but, like, I was audibly responding to the events of this book, and every now and again the people sitting next to me would give me looks. I'd just be like, whew, oh, like, just getting so heated and so pissed off and hurting for this situation, and to think that this stuff still goes on every day. I mentioned him earlier, and I'll mention him again, Trump, with the whole let's build a wall thing. All the cameras, policemen are starting to take their cameras off using the excuse that it's eating up too much data and it costs too much to store the video on their suits, so they're not doing it anymore, and people are dying in the streets because for a race war that continues to go on. People aren't safe. And it's just, I've said this in the past, I grew up in a household where we had all kinds of people coming in and out. And I am currently friends with people all over the world, thanks to this podcast and this website and everything. And I cannot even fathom for a moment where I would try to stand in somebody's way or look down on someone because of their race or their beliefs. It's insane to me. It's just absolutely insane. Mm-hmm. And this book, I'm sorry, Joe, I'm going on and on, but
no, please.
I mean, this book. There's one thing they do at the very end. This is not really a spoiler, but the book ends with John Lewis talking to one of his constituents, one of his people, about the idea of making a comic book out of his story and his life story. And his guy is kind of like, hey, John, I mean, are you sure you want to do that? Comic books? Come on, man. And he says, like, of course, yes, comics, because this story needs to be heard by everyone. Mm-hmm. And that killed me, because I would never have picked up a book like this. I don't like reading about politics because, quite frankly, they depress the shit out of me. You know, I see enough things on Twitter and on Facebook and on the news, and it just bums me out. And I'm not trying to ignore the problems of the world, but I got enough problems of my own right now that I can't be adding to the pile all the time. And the fact that he made this book because he wanted to get it into the hands of people like me, and I got it, and I feverishly read it. I read whole sections of this book over again just to drill in the messaging into my head so that it would be perfectly clear to me what he was trying to get through to the audience. And just like when I read Mouse earlier in the year, it has that same importance of a piece of history that if you don't have knowledge about it, you can read something that is entertaining but informative as well about it, and hopefully come away changed, because I know that I was. I mean, I loved the living daylights out of this book, but I'm going to be quiet now.
Let me just jump in. We have two education professionals here, mm-hmm. So I'm not saying this to be a knock on the school systems or anything else. It's about the way we bring knowledge into our heads often and how it resonates.
Yeah.
You probably read these stories in history books.
Absolutely.
As some little header, as part of a chapter, and here was a picture of the bridge.
Yep.
And mm-hmm. Maybe it stuck with you a little bit until you had to take the test, and then it was gone.
Yep.
And now seeing it and feeling it viscerally, because there it is. It now means something. It resonates in a way that it'll never go out of your heart and head.
Yeah. The book opens. You mentioned the bridge. The book opens with everybody marching across the bridge, and John Lewis turns to one of his friends and fellow marchers, and he asks him if he can swim, because all the cops and all the dogs and all the tear gas, they're all waiting at the end of this bridge.
Yeah, the real footage.
And he turns to him. He's like, "Can you swim?" And he's like, "No, I can't." And he goes, "Neither do I, but we might have to learn." I was just, oh my God.
Yeah. And the truth is that it's real, you know, like these moments are real. And Selma, which is an amazing film, Ava DuVernay did an amazing job capturing this one moment, Selma, last year or a year and a half ago. Powerful, powerful film. And that moment's in there too. What March does so well is it opens with that scene. But what Lewis does with March is it's about 1960 and 1961 and 1962 and 63 and 64 and 65. And he walks us through so much history in these three volumes that it is important. And I think, Bob, you used the word visceral there. That last page you're talking about, Steve, the man he's talking to is Andrew Aden, his director of policy.
Yes.
His advisor, and when he says that, I got that same thing. Like, this is a story that needs to be not only read by everyone, but seen by everyone. Mm-hmm. And there is footage. You can go on YouTube and find this footage that Nate Powell is illustrating so brilliantly in these panels. You can find this video and see and find these these speeches. If you don't follow John Lewis on Twitter, or if you haven't followed his career, I've been a big fan of his for a very long time. If you've never seen him speak, if you've never experienced the kind of wonderful like magic of this man, go to Twitter and YouTube and just like search him out, because the man is truly a legend, as the book demonstrates. But he is also so clearly one of the kindest and kind of most empathetic and most effective people living today. And it's truly a gift that he's a part of our government in a lot of ways, that there are people like him still representing us. I think one of the things that I love about the book is that you can see why Congressman Lewis is and was and continues to be such a beloved politician. He so very clearly believes in the kind of democratic values of our country, right? Ideals of freedom and of speech and of representation and of equality. And he strives to push for those things in his day job. But the dude has like, and the book shows this, but he's like bled for this country, you know,
literally
like for over 50 years. And he still is. After the tragic Pulse nightclub shooting last June, he led that Democratic sit-in in Congress, where all the congressmen and women sat on the floor until and they tried to get movement on a gun safety bill. And those tweets that he sent out from the freaking floor of Congress were just so powerful and moving. I do remember crying then too. And knowing that 50 years prior to that, he was doing the exact same thing at lunch counters in the South is mind-boggling. And that the book so clearly establishes that is a testament to the efficacy. I knew that he marched across the bridge. I knew that he spoke at the March on Washington. I didn't know how involved he was in the Freedom Rides, which is a part of the, going back to Bob's comment, something that we do learn, right? Those kind of Montgomery bus boycotts and the Freedom Rides and everything. But John Lewis was there, man, and he tells stories about that. He talks about Freedom Summer, which I've studied in depth, and the kind of way that they tried to bring education out into some of these states. And how he walks us through so carefully and clearly through the jam-packed 1963. I feel like the last half of book one into all of book two was like 1963. Like everything that happened there. And like he walks you through every single piece and he introduces us to all of these players. He's so careful to introduce us to things that we don't know. or haven't heard much about, like the Mississippi Freedom delegation that went to Atlantic City to try and get delegates to vote for representation. Mm-hmm. Women like Diane Nash and Fannie Lou Hamer, like he's so specific about including them and bringing them back up. And he gives Fannie Lou Hamer an entire full page spread and talks about her like the soul and heart of the delegation movement there in 1964. And that he's so ready to dedicate that time to women of the movement and the challenges of the movement too. I think one of the things that I love about history and that I love talking about with my students about history is that it's not clean, it's dirty. And he talks very painfully at times about the conflict between his organization, SNCC, and the Southern Christian Leadership Coalition and CORE and the NAACP and the kind of new versus old and the conservative movement versus the kind of more progressive and nonviolent movement there. And he talks painfully about moments where he felt separate from what was going on there, and there's so much honesty there and authenticity that it's the most accurate representation of the movement that I've almost ever experienced. Mm-hmm. And that's speaking as someone who's taken courses in this, you know, and studied the 60s history in particular extensively. But March, yeah, it's a comic book, but it does it so clearly, and I think mm-hmm. that's a testament to what John Lewis has lived and is able to retell, that Andrew Aden, who is a comic book fan, and he talks about that in interviews and in his bio, he's been reading comics since his mom got him comics back when he was a kid, and Nate Powell too. I think one of the things I love about the book is you go from March 1, which was 2013, to March 3, which was last month, and you can see the evolution of his craft and the clarity of his lines and the depth of his work and the crowd scenes and the way that he stages the protest. It's just the evolution there is just so brilliant. It's an important book. Yeah. And it all goes back to you know, John Lewis, I love the story that he tells about picking up that 10-cent copy of Martin Luther King and the Montgomery Story, a comic book that someone gave him in like 1955, 1956. And when he turns to Aden at the end of that book, at the end of volume 3, and he says, "I think I want to write a comic book," that image is in your head. Yeah. He was a teenager at the mm-hmm. time, but young John Lewis holding that book, which he shows us in volume 1, and it comes all the way back in volume 3. And I didn't even touch on the Obama stuff, because that's where I was like, there's that moment with the postcard, he just gives it to him, and it's just this, "Because of you, John." Oh, right in the heart.
I was a wreck. I read that part on the plane, and like the guy next to me, I'm like biting my bottom lip, trying not to cry. I'm like, God, it's such a get up and cheer cut. Kind of moment.
I know. It's the hard cut from that moment, "Because of you, John," to him in his iconic trench with his rucksack walking to the bridge, and you know what's coming. And when Barack Obama writes on that card, "Because of you, John," it's because you walked across that damn bridge, you know. And like, it's just such a story, but it's real. Mm-hmm. And like, our history is, and I'm talking a lot too, and I'm sorry, and I'll get to you.
It's all right, Mara, man. Join
me. I'll let you talk in a second. But like, there's a, like, our history, and I tell this to the kids all the time, and I talked to them about World War I and the Lost Generation and the 1920s, because we're learning Great Gatsby, and I'm telling them, like, our history is filled with incredible narrative that fiction tries to capture, Great Gatsby tries to capture. But something like March tells us that true history and achieves that same magic that fiction aspires to. you know, and there are moments like that in our own history that it's not just history class and it's not just a test. If you pay attention and if you pay attention to the narrative of who we are, like there's a richness of existence there that I'm so glad March exists, because it captures that and it makes it accessible and authentic for everyone to read. Mm-hmm. I'm going to stop for a little bit. I need to sit
compose
back.
Yourself a little bit.
Yeah.
So we've talked a lot about the importance of the book and things like that. And I want to talk to something that I felt while reading these three books, and that is shame and guilt. Being a Southern white woman, it can be very, like, obviously I personally had nothing to do with the actions that took place in the 60s in the South, but you know, I'm a product of that culture. With the exception of a 3-year stint out in California as my childhood, I grew up in Texas and in Arkansas. And so, I mean, just driving to work, I pass by homes that have Confederate flags posted right in the middle of the yard, right next to that stupid snake, don't tread on me, whatever. drive by pickup trucks with Confederate flags on them and an AK-40, whatever, hanging in the back. Like, that's a little bit of the culture that I come from. And you know, it's something that I'm very aware of all the time with, you know, how racial relations are in this country and how terrible they are now. And reading a book like this, reading these, this series, this trilogy, you know, it almost makes me feel like we haven't done enough. Like, yeah. Look at where we are now. We're still experiencing a lot of these problems. And it almost feels like, have we, you know, people keep saying things like, well, there's no racism anymore, or, you know, we have equal rights, or, you know, stuff like that. And that's definitely something you hear a lot in the South, because there's a bit of denial and trying to sweep that away because it is terrible. And, oh yeah, we fixed it.
Yeah.
We
what more laws. Do these people want?
Yeah. Sort of yeah. Mentality. Which was the narrative in the book. Like,
well, that's part of the book too. Like, and again, like, yeah, we got the Equal Rights Act, no, the Voting yeah. Rights Act and the Civil Rights Bill. But
there's still barriers.
Something I talk to my kids about is, like, legislation does not change hearts and minds.
No.
You know, it does codify the things that we aspire to, but the struggle continues, mm-hmm. because the culture continues. And that's why I love the dedication for all three volumes, right? You open this book and it says, to the past and future children of the movement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Lewis has been fighting for this for 50 years, and he's been in Congress longer than I've been alive, and he's still sitting on that floor, you know? Like, if things aren't going. Yep. I think one of the things that I really loved about how he tells the story is that he is so clearly a humble servant of the movement, mm-hmm. right? There's some great moments where the March on Washington, I think, the speeches at Washington, I think, is a perfect example of this. Like, he gives us his speech. He talks like, I was sixth to speak that day, and he gives us his speech. And it takes like a couple of pages to get through, and he talks about having to revise it because, you know, some of the older members of the NAACP and CORE were like, you need to change this or whatever. And those are some great scenes. But the second the speech is done, he doesn't give us a crowd scene. He doesn't give us an applause. He doesn't even reflect on his speech. You turn the page after his speech is done, and it says, Martin Luther King also spoke that day. Right. He's not writing the book out of some desire to kind of say, like, I'm John Lewis and I was there. He's doing it to tell the story of all of these people's stories. And I think that moment is kind of that perfect example where it's like, I don't want the applause for that speech. I'm not even here to reflect on my speech. I'm here to move on and take you to the next thing. And he so clearly still venerates people like Dr. King, and he talks about Malcolm X, and he talks about
the presidents, Kennedy, and he talks about Johnson, and he talks about Robert Kennedy, and he gives us all of these moments, but at no point does he say, you know, here I am, you know, here I am on the, put me on the pedestal. That's not what this book is about. And I think that that speaks to his humility, and I think that speaks to the story that he wants to tell. And it just like made it, again, it just made it the clearer what the focus of this book was for me.
Mm-hmm. Right on, man.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah. Well, I think we're all in agreement that March is pretty much recommended reading, required reading for everyone.
Also recommended by Carolyn Coca's daughter. Carolyn Coca's daughter. Carolyn Coca's daughter. There's a great piece that they do their kind of mother-daughter reviews on Talking Comics every once in a while. And they did one on March 1 and 2. Carolyn sent us a great email before the show of sending that article to Andrew Aiden and Aiden giving a very nice response in return.
Yay.
Talking Comics, bringing people together.
Yeah.
Anna did a great job with that, and it does or should let people know that this book is appropriate for younger readers. There's a lot to lot to digest. I'm not saying it's easy.
There's a lot of language in the book. I mean,
but if you're reading with a parent,
right?
Yeah,
you know, the parent should be able to explain why the N word should not be used and why it was used in that context and why it's bad.
And why people are doing bad things to each other and what the struggle was about. Yeah. It's a heck of a teaching moment.
The book doesn't pull punches. You know, like it shows you what people saw on TV. Mm-hmm. You know, that's one of the things that you do talk about in history class. The way that the media really push the civil rights movement. And the same thing happened with Vietnam in the late 60s too. But and Powell does that in the artwork. Every time something's going on, you see in the background, flash, flash, or look, a camera guy or some press guy with a camera snapping it. And you know in your head, it's subtle, but you know this is on the news. This is in the paper, you know? And it's just it's so brilliantly crafted. Too. It's not just the story. The story is just so important and you got to read it. But as a comic book, it's one of the best executed things I've read, especially that last volume is one of the most well executed things I've read in the genre. Definitely.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I guess we should mention that it comes from IDW's imprint. And I cannot for the life of me remember that imprint's
Top
name.
Shelf.
Top Shelf.
Yep, Top Shelf.
Yeah. So the physical copies are fantastic, real easy for young hands to grab. They're not heavy or anything like that. They're soft cover. At least the ones I have are soft cover. I don't know if they have hardcover versions. But
I think they're all soft cover. Yeah,
yeah, I have the soft cover box set.
Yeah, so definitely accessible for, you know, at least physically accessible for younger people. Any other thoughts on March? Any.
Can I ask you guys something that I ask my kids all the time?
Sure.
What was like the moment that like popped for you? The thing that you remember the most after you put the books down?
Oh, there's so many of those.
The first one that comes to your head.
I already talked about it, but that moment with everyone standing outside.
The second
the hospital,
one that comes to your head.
the second one that comes to my head is the Obama moment.
Yeah.
You know? Go ahead.
I was going to say, for me, it's that it's in that first volume. It's that all black page where he's standing outside his house waiting for the bus to come pick him up for school. And he's woke because he went to the north and saw the differences there. And he comes back and sees kind of the discrepancies between white and black even more. And having that all black background and his siblings kind of, you know, they're not making eye contact with the reader, but he's like looking right at the reader. I was like, whoa, he's about to go do something. He's young. He's going to go change the world.
Yeah. That whole segment of those, I would have picked that one too. Also, there's you're going through the Freedom Rider era and seeing people missing flyers on poles. Yeah. And you start the cost of everyone trying to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And as someone who, I was young when this stuff was going on, but as a northerner and a father who grew up in Manhattan in very mixed circumstances, it's incomprehensible that the world was still acting that way.
Yeah.
And there it was on the news every night, the, you know, Bull Connor and dogs and hoses. And how is this possible to treat someone that badly simply because of the color of their skin?
Yeah. One of the other things that I really appreciated about the book, and Joey touched on it a little bit before, are the speeches throughout all three volumes, that these are speeches that I've heard of or were maybe drastically summarized in a textbook mm-hmm. while growing up. And seeing them in their entirety with the art there to really like set the tone and drive it home. And after you've been so much like through so much with these people as you're reading the story, that when they get up to speak and they say what they're going to say, it really, really got in there for me. And then the messaging of it and everything was just so inspiring and enlightening. And I haven't read anything in a really long time that has kind of like grabbed both sides of my face and, you know, peeled my eyes back and just been like, read. And then, you know what, if you didn't understand some of the terminology, take the time, go back and read it again. And when I see something like, and I want to talk about it in a week, that's, you know, three volumes, and these are healthy volumes, is a little bit daunting that like I want to get through them. This was not something where it was a race to the end just to have this conversation. I really like, we put this conversation off a whole week just so we all could kind of have something to say about this and really sink our teeth into it. And I loved going back and reading like sometimes like 20 pages over again just leading up to some of those moments and the traveling that went on. And when he goes to Africa and the difference there when he's kind of walking around Africa and he sees a black pilot and how, that moment for him was so revolutionary. And for me, following him through the story, even I was like, whoa.
Yeah, dude, like, I remember there's a panel where, like, and he's kind of talking about it. You know, this is the first time I ever saw a black pilot. And then the panel is just an open spread. And in the foreground are two, I guess, I can't remember where he was, West Africa, I suppose, so it's one of those countries. And it's like two cops, two black police officers, after reading 2.5 volumes of the police antagonizing John Lewis and his comrades there, and then right in the foreground, it's such a brilliant moment, and it's quiet, and they don't say like, I even saw black cops, like it doesn't need to be said,
right?
Like, you know. And Steve, it was like the exact same thing. Like, I was just like, oh my god. It was a weird moment for me.
I had
to find myself there.
If I could just tell a quick little story, I finished this book three on the airplane. And we were landing, and I came home on Sunday. So I came home on September 11th. And it was a day of just people were extra alert at the airports when I was going through security and things of that nature. And I had just finished this book, and it turned out that, you know, you always see the stewardesses and the pilot when you're leaving the airplane. And my pilot was a black pilot. So I had just read this, like, tremendously epic educational ride, right? And I gave him this knowing nod. Well, I have my headphones on and I'm leaving the plane, and I just gave him like kind of like a Fight Club nod, just, you know, like, good job for getting here, like, everybody's safe and sound. It's September 11th, like, we're not talking about it, but we both know. And so I walk past him and I give him this nod, and he just, his lips part. And all you see are rows of just shining white teeth. And he puts his thumbs up and gives me the biggest grin, being like, I know, man. I got you here. It's all good. Let's get off of this plane. And it was such a nice little, like, cherry on top of the sundae when I had just closed this book and put it back in my bag. And I look up, and there's this guy. And I'm like, I don't even know you, and I love you. You're awesome.
Yeah.
Such a jovial expression on his face, and it was great. It was such a nice capper after reading this tremendous series.
Yeah, they were in Guinea, by the way. I looked it up.
Okay.
So
awesome.
Okay.
Yeah. Great moments.
Yeah.
I love this book.
Yeah. And I'm sure we'll be talking about it again once we get to our end of the year awards. Since Volume 3 did come out during 2016, it puts it technically in the running for Best Graphic Novel of 2016 for the Talking Comics Awards. So if you listeners have not read it yet and you want to get a head start on our basically our top five list for the end of the year, you're probably safe bet to go ahead and read this.
Yeah, and if
I gotta say, I reread, I walked to my bookstore and they had Volume 3 in stock, so I bought it. And when I got home, this was probably Saturday I did this, I reread 1 and 2 on Saturday and read 3 on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
So it did not take me long at all to get through this. It they are kind of like good sized volumes, but they go, you know, you're so enriched and engrossed, especially once we get into Volume 2. And the movement really takes off. The book mm-hmm. really takes off too.
Yeah. Well, awesome. Are there any other, we don't have any other comics on our list to talk about today, unless you guys have one that you definitely want to throw in right before we peace out here.
No, I'm good.
I think we're okay.
I just have an announcement or two at the close of the show, if you don't mind.
Oh, okay. If you want to go ahead and
actually.
Oh, you do? Do you want to go first?
No. Well, actually, yes. Why not?
Go for
I'll
it.
Go for it.
Yes.
I just want to wish a very happy birthday to two longtime listeners and friends of the Talking Comics family who share a birthday on September 15th. Ooh. Hugh Perry and Sarah Miles.
Hugh.
Their birthday is September 15th. So happy
birthday?
Happy birthday to them.
Happy birthday. That's
Yay.
Awesome.
Hugh and Sarah. Yay.
Fantastic.
Hugh shows up again.
Yeah.
Right in the show. Every time.
He's an important
Just
part.
Can't
of
stay off the show. Can't stay off. Right,
Hugh and Wonder Woman, pillars of the show.
Yeah.
Yes. Wonder Woman.
Happy birthday to Sarah and Hugh.
Absolutely.
Yes. All right, Steve.
So I just want to put an all-points bulletin that the next Top Shelf Book Club podcast is happening this Friday, and you all can look for it on Monday of next week. Again, the book is Joe the Barbarian, Grant Morrison, and Sean Gordon Murphy. I've written up an outline with some pretty cool questions. And it's a wild book, and I think we're going to have a really good time, and I urge you all to check it out. And, and the other thing that I want to mention really quick is I mentioned earlier in the year wanting to do some more music-related stuff on the site, and at the start of the year, I posted my top 20 albums of the year, so on and so forth. And one of the bands that I mentioned in that list actually reached out, and we've been friends for a couple of years. They used to go by the name Sister Crayon, but now they've been signed to Warner Brothers. Since they've been touring with the Deftones, as soon as they wrap up this little tour with the album Leaf, they're going to be touring with Tricky after that. So they're skyrocketing and really, really getting up there. I've known them almost since day one, and they're just tremendously talented people. It's very atmospheric, electronic, just high energy, beautiful, like. Oh, it's so, so, so good. But anyway, this Saturday night at a club in New York City called La Poison Rouge, they're going to be playing with... Oh.
I love La Poison Rouge.
Yeah, man.
It is a great venue. Awesome venue.
Yes. So they're playing with the album Leaf. They go on promptly at 7 p.m. There are still tickets available. And I have been invited by them to come and check out the show and do some media stuff. So I'm going to be doing photos and doing a full write-up of the concert for the site. And if you're in the area Saturday night, you got nothing to do, and you're in town, buy a ticket to La Poison Rouge and come and rock out with me at Rituals of Mine and the Album Leaf. It's going to be awesome.
Nice.
And that's my little... It's my little billboard for that.
Nice. Like it.
Yeah.
So that's going to be it for this episode. And you can send us comments or questions through our email, podcast@talkingcomicbooks.com or on Twitter @talkingcomics. Don't forget to check out talkingcomicbooks.com for all of those reviews that we mentioned at the top of the show from our new writers. Yeah. Lots and lots of stuff going up. Yeah, you definitely don't want to miss any of that. As well as our other podcasts, because we cover, not we specifically, we as a site, cover movies and games and TV, just tons and tons of stuff. Also D&D, so that's pretty cool. The next Legendary Runs episode is Walt Simonson's Thor, which, man, I gotta get to reading because I'm not very far in that at all.
Isn't that like 1,000 issues?
That's a lot of issues.
More or less, and I'm only like 6 in, so.
Oh man.
Yeah. Well,
that's why that Straczynski run is so good. It's like 10 issues.
Well, I keep trying to read it in the omnibus, and the omnibus is like heavier than me. And
you must be worthy to pick it up.
Oh, I love it.
Nice.
But it's, I mean, I'm like, you guys gonna see my bicep?
Yeah, look at that.
This run, they're so strong. Yes. So strong. So look forward to that. More and more comics. And of course, we'll be back next week with another episode of new comics from this past week. So make sure you read, because who knows if I'm going to spoil something or not.
Yes.
Yeah.
Most likely will. So, Bob, where can listeners find you?
Bob Reier at talkingcomicbooks.com.
And Steve?
I am at @dead_anchoress on Twitter and Instagram.
Very nice.
And Joey?
Joey at talkingcomicbooks.com. No, I'm just kidding. Twitter and Instagram at Joey Brachino.
Okay. And you can find me on Twitter at Megamaramon. So, for Bob.
Good evening, all.
Steve?
Mara's biceps are totally bigger than mine.
And Joey.
We gonna march.
Yes. I'm Mara Wood. And until next time, to be continued.